Good afternoon, folks, or good evening. Welcome aboard. Welcome back. Jeff Metcalf with you here on WorldNet Daily Radio. I have generally, over the last decade or so, been pretty critical of our Congress critters who reside in that 87 square miles surrounded by reality of the District of Criminals. However, there are exceptions, and our next guest is one of those. He's definitely one of the good guys. And although I primarily want to talk to him about the International Criminal Court thing, there's a couple other things that I want to get to as well. I'm delighted to welcome to the program Texas Congressman Ron Paul. Good afternoon, Mr. Congressman.
Hello. Glad to be with you.
Good to talk to you again. Before I get into this International Criminal Court thing, yesterday I had a story, and I love it when the good guys use the procedural finesses that routinely are used to bludgeon us. Yesterday, we had this piece about this seldom-employed law to block implementation of medical privacy. You want to explain to our listeners what you're doing?
Oh, yes. I've introduced a House concurrent resolution that would stop the imposition of 1,500 pages of regulations that are said to be designed to protect our privacy. It's sort of like the Bank Privacy Act, you know, in the early 1970s. They passed that bill, and it did everything to invade our privacy. So 1,500 pages, I'm a physician, to tell the doctors that they ought to respect patient privacy. We never had any regulations or pages or law. We had ethics and rules, and it was understood that you never released information. But
and actually, as I understand the details of this deal, is it actually opens it up where third parties can be notified without the patient knowing about it.
It's exactly the opposite of privacy. And a lot of the congressmen are going to be snookered into this and say, oh, yeah, we have to protect privacy. If we don't vote for this, we're not voting for privacy. So my job is, I see it as trying to let as many people know as possible that this is doing exactly the opposite. It literally sets up national medical data banks, allows this medical records to be used by the government. You see, they don't think if the government has the information that that's so bad. They want to regulate maybe corporations and things, but if the government has the information for research purposes or to study the efficiency of the government health system or for any kind of a concocted reason, and then maybe inadvertently on occasion it might be used for political reasons, you know, like the FBI files. So I think it's very, very dangerous. The resolution I've introduced would block that, just as we've never used...
By the way, it's important to note that if you didn't do this, if this isn't affected, if nothing happens, by April 14th, bada-bing, bada-boom, it happens.
That's it. That's the law. And this, the authority was given in 1996. Unfortunately, this was one of the things that occurred after the Republicans took control of the Congress and Clinton went along with it. So the authority's been set up. Each year I've been able to block using any funds to set up a national data bank and using the Social Security number as a national ID. But they're progressing steadily. You know, they'll let me maybe block it for a year, but they keep coming back. This is a bold step, and it's being done by the regulators, and I'm just hoping that I can alert enough people to this problem so that Congress will wake up.
What, if any, kind of support are you getting from your colleagues?
You know, this was just introduced Thursday. So I have not done a Dear Colleague letter. I personally have spoken with Dick Armey, and Armey's pretty good on this issue. He's helped me get the legislation passed before to block the setting up and the using of the national ID card.
I actually saw something in the story yesterday that shocked me because it was a statement by Donna Shalala that I agreed with. She said the regulations would affect the life of every American. She's right, because what she didn't say was that it would affect them negatively.
Yeah, but for her, I mean, it affects it in a way that government knows more about you. And, you know, since they believe in one health provider, one health service, and And one socialized system, you know, to them, this is efficiency. You know, this is what they need.
This isn't the camel's nose in the tent. It's him backing in and defecating in the corner.
It is really bad. But medicine has gone downhill a good bit in the last 10 years. It's very, very expensive, and quality is down, and privacy is disappearing, and choices are not there. So this is just one more bold step, and there's not... I'm hoping we can stop this, but if not, the only thing left for us in medicine would be able to get these medical savings account where people can opt out, you know, just get out of the system. And if you wanted to go out and pay your own doctors and your insurance, at least you would get your money back off your taxes. That, to me, is the only thing, because we're not going to reverse this. I mean, just look at the burden it would be to say, well, why is the government involved in medicine under our Constitution?
Why is the government involved in education?
Yeah, both of these. And yet, look at the bold steps forward this year with education. You know, I think it's over and done with. There's no more fight. You know, at least Republicans, up until this last election, the platform and the president always ran saying, well, at least we say we're against the Department of Education and that we don't believe the federal government should be involved. And yet that was removed.
Well, a couple of years, one of the platform planks of the Republican Party was to eliminate the Department of Education.
Up until this year, you know. And, of course, I was there on my first tour of duty in Congress when it was passed, and that was with Carter. And so when Reagan ran in 80, that was, remember, he was going to get rid of the Department of Education, Department of Energy, and quickly forgot about it once in office. But we've always had it on our platform up until this last year. But Bush says, no, take it out. We need more money in education. And he's increasing this budget. He's already asked for, I think, 11% increase. The Democrats love all the increases. There will be no cuts. And who knows, I'll bet you this budget could be 15% higher than it was last year.
I found that amusing when the president acknowledged that in Washington speak, a cut really isn't a cut, it's just a reduction in the increase.
That's the terminology, and yet you don't even see many of those episodes where they actually reduce the proposed increases. But, yeah, it's all gimmicks, just like this talking about this huge surplus. I mean, that is just so much deception. And own standards, with this downturn in the economy, all those numbers are absolutely worthless.
I forget who acknowledged it. I think it was someone from the Fed several months ago, who said that if you used general accounting procedures that are required of corporations, there ain't no surplus.
There's no surplus. And of course, if we were held to the same standards as an insurance company, and talked about the Social Security system and fund, you know, we'd all be the managers of the fund would be in charge with fraud. I mean, we should be charged with fraud, the people who are supposed to run this program. So insurance people would be put in jail if they ran their program like Social Security, because there's no real assets there. You know, it's all in government debt, and that means that some future taxpayer has to pay for every single penny that goes out. Every single day from Social Security comes from a current taxpayer.
I apologize for digressing to that, but I just thought it was a cool move that you would try. I love it when the good guys use the same kind of procedural finesses that the masters use to control us. The primary purpose we wanted to talk about today was this International Criminal Court that I've been itching and moaning about for ages now. Right. Explain just how bad this would be.
Well, it could be a disaster. I mean, it could mean that once this is institutionalized, that someday, you know, down the line, maybe in the next generation, we would have one court, and it would be a world court. Already we know that the World Trade Organization preempts state law and our federal law, and we have to abide by it, and, you know, with environmental things and labor and that's why the left sometimes comes in and joins us on that.
There have been two or three occasions in my career when I have gone overboard on something, and NAFTA and GATT, I admit to having fallen victim to that. I mean, I just went ballistic over it, because in both cases, in NAFTA is even worse, because you've got executive committees who are meeting in secret. You don't know who they are. They make a decision. You don't know what it is. But you can't either litigate it, and you can't go to Congress with it. And the World Trade Organization, at least they're out in the open with it. But the whole concept that someone somewhere else can do something and we don't have the constitutionally guaranteed protections is an abomination.
Yeah, and this is the whole principle. So the principle is established there, but the so-called free traders in Washington strongly endorse this. Now, this is going over into the criminal areas, and who knows what? There'll be a U.N. tax and a U.N. ban on owning weapons and all kinds of things that may come up that our American citizens could be called into court, which means that, you know, if there's a riot in some city, maybe they'd say, well, that's genocide, so therefore we're going to have the U.N. Army come in here and arrest these people. This is what it could come to. I just don't think it's quite that bad, you know, today or tomorrow, but I think the principles are there and the standards are there for that to happen someday. And if it's established and sitting there and you have certain circumstances and conditions and a different president, you know, who knows what would happen. At least this president is saying he doesn't want to have anything to do with the International Criminal Court. But at the same time, we're not sure he's going to express to the world that we will rescind the signature that Clinton put ICC treaty.
I want to talk a little bit about the technical aspects of that in a moment, but first I have to take a pause, so please stay with us. We'll return with Congressman Ron Paul as we continue our discussion about this International Criminal Court. And it's really insidious because it demonstrates something we've been talking about, and that is you're not going to get bit legislatively, you're going to get bit by treaty. Take it to the limit. 21 minutes past the hour, Jeff Metcalf back with Congressman Ron Paul. Mr. Congressman, those of us who care about liberty and freedom and our constitutional absolutists end up fighting all these skirmishes with congressional types over various challenges to our liberty and freedom. But the feeling is that the way they're really going to bite us in the butt isn't through what you and your colleagues are talking about, but through treaties. And isn't this a classic example of how that could happen?
I think so. I think they are systematically undermining the concept of nations. Just in a way, it's very similar to what happened to our history from the very beginning of our country, how they systematically undermined the principle of an individual state. And then there was the dramatic changes that occurred with the Civil War, then, of course, with the grandiose social schemes of Roosevelt. So every year...
Well, your colleagues may not know, but we still do have the 10th Amendment.
Yeah, but they know it, but they don't care about it, and they don't follow it. So they reinterpret that, and they don't want to be reminded about it. But, of course, if they did it, they'd be I think I would be not voting by myself so often. You know, I look at the 10th Amendment rather seriously in my oath of office. And
do you have a pause coming out of the cloakroom sometime and think, gee, wouldn't it be cool if the guy sitting next to me was a Lewis McFadden or Charles Lindbergh's dad or somebody like that?
I think it would really be great, and I'm always looking for them, and I do get some help, you know, on occasion. It's just that it's not consistent across the board. It'll be hit and miss, and I can't. They don't have, you know, a sound, principled philosophy. It's just like, oh, yeah, okay, if you get to them, you explain it to them. Yeah, that makes sense. And then one or two or three will, you know, vote with me, but maybe the next day said it'll either be impractical for their district or they'll say, oh, I don't quite understand it that way. This is necessary, something like that.
Let me ask you this, because this is kind of basic, and it's a pet peeve of mine. I've been bitching about this for a decade. All you and all your colleagues, you swear an oath to preserve and protect the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That oath means something. How can a congressman, 20 seconds after he puts his hand down and removes his hand from the Bible, set about to introduce, author, and lobby for legislation which is specifically designed to undermine, abrogate, or trash the document they've just sworn to preserve and protect?
I guess they buy into this argument that, you know, we live in a different age and it was written for a different time. And it's just
all... Well, they just took the oath 20 seconds ago, for crying out loud.
I know. They take the oath, but they do rationalize. And then I another argument I hear is, well, yeah, I tend to agree with you, but that means you're just voting your own philosophy. You're overly rigid, and we have to vote our district, which means we have to vote the money that put us here. We have to vote our district. We have to do this. We can't be overly rigid with our personal views like we believe in the Constitution.
Well, now, see, this isn't a question of being overly rigid, because, frankly, if you were really to start, you know, picking nits here, if one of your colleagues were to violate his oath of office, technically, wouldn't they be guilty of at least perjury or fraud, if not treason?
Well, they would be, but not many. It's not likely to end up in court. But you're right. You're technically right. They're immoral, and I think it's unconstitutional, and it's illegal. Of course, sometimes it's legal because laws get passed, but it certainly isn't constitutional. But, you know, all of this, I believe strongly that we should do what we say when promised. We should have a moral code, but it's very important as a legislator that you believe in the rule of law, because there certainly are things in the Constitution that I could improve upon. But
yeah, the problem is the law they believe in is the golden rule. The guy with the gold makes the rules.
Yeah, that's it. But they don't wait, and they don't say, well, yes, it should be changed. We should change the law. So once you say, well, we should allow the president to wage war because we live in difficult times, and he needs to be able to wage war.
Or more realistically, because we don't want to have to make the decision and take the heat for it.
Well, or if you do it once, you can do it any time. You know, you don't have to just say it one time. Because once you do it, it's sort of like taking your first drink. And you're right. It does blow my mind to think how much the Congress gives up, how much authority to the president, to the executive branch, and to the judicial branch. And they just seem to go out of their way to give more authority to the executive branch.
I have never understood this. The framers gave us three branches of government specifically because we didn't want a king, right? So they give us the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. And each one of you guys has a specific job function. A reasonable person, if such a fictional character existed, would expect that the legislature would be jealous of their territory.
Yeah, but they're not. One day we had a bill on the education committee, and it was obviously unconstitutional. I brought the subject up. And the chairman said, well, that may be true, but that's not our responsibility.
Bull feathers. Absolutely, it's your responsibility.
Yeah, he says, we'll wait until it goes to the court and they can decide. And I thought, I just sort of threw my hands up. Oh, my. What is this going on?
What did they have? I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago. And I think it was a congressman from Florida. It might have been Shays. I can't remember. But he introduced some legislation that it made all the sense in the world that no one could introduce anything unless they could provide a citing from the Constitution that authorized it. And I joked with him at the time saying that, you know, it'd be cool if we could make that retroactive. He said we'd have to get rid of 90% of the laws we had.
Okay, that was John Shattuck from Arizona.
Shattuck, okay.
Now, interestingly, that never got passed in the law, but it is a rule of the House. And the rule is, quote, followed, close quote. It is followed. So you go and you pick up a piece of legislation. I can remember one that just struck my interest, and that had to do with the Export-Import Bank. Give China gets $5 billion of export subsidies. So I went and said, what's the constitutional justification for this? So they cite the coinage clause, that they can coin money, and that to them was to extend credit to communist nations. And so we have this problem of, they can cite the Constitution. So that law would never do any good, even if it was the law. The General Welfare Clause and the Interstate Commerce Clause, everything has been so messed up.
Well, the Commerce Clause, we could do 6 hours just in that. But the thing that I never understood is why Congress would say, well, let the courts sort it out. The whole purpose of three branches, I mean, that shouldn't have to happen.
They don't understand that they're supposed to interpret the Constitution just as a judge would interpret it. They don't see the same responsibility. And I think it's their upbringing, you know, it's the fact that they have not really studied constitutional law. They have not been taught this in college, and they're not interested in really paying attention, because they might subtly have some respect for what I do, but, you know, deep down inside they say...
They marginalize you.
They say, you know, this guy is really out of it. And if I didn't go home and talk to my people and get some support and get reelected, they'd have me doubting it, too. But I'm, absolutely convinced that we who believe this way are on the right track. We are much more correct than anything that they do, and that there are a lot of people around the country and a lot of people who feel frustrated and feel good about somebody trying to stand up for these views.
Recently, I was just rereading a series of magnificent rants by Congressman Louis McFadden. I think it was 1933, around there or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I was listening to the language he was using and how harsh he was in his criticism, specifically of the Federal Reserve. And I can't conceive of anyone who would even attempt to give a speech like that, with the exception of maybe, I don't know, you, Jim Traficant, if the moon's in a certain phase, or Bob Barr.
Yeah, and most of them, it isn't so much that they love the Fed, if they don't really understand the system, but they know the Fed's important because the Fed gave us...
Mr. Congressman, I'm getting yelled at here. We're going to take a brief pause. Please stay with me. We'll be back and continue this discussion. Congressman Ron Paul, I'm Jeff Metcalf on WorldNet Daily Radio. Four minutes past the hour. Jeff Metcalf here with Congressman Ron Paul. I'm going to drag myself by the mustache and pull us back on point because specifically we want to talk about this International Criminal Court. And, Mr. Congressman, I'd like you to explain to our listeners the kind of sleazy way that Clinton approved this thing in the first place.
Well, you know, the meeting in Rome drawing up this treaty was a couple years ago, and it was unpopular here and nothing was done, but it was... at that time that Clinton was working on all his pardons, that was on the December 31st, the last day of the year, he had this treaty signed. And I'm sure he did this thinking that it would quietly go by for a while without too much talking about it.
But it may have also been a way of flipping off Congress and the Senate, because the thing doesn't count until the Senate approves it, and the Senate's not going to approve it.
That's right, and yet we are still concerned about it because just as we don't act within the rule of law very often, the world sort of takes upon themselves to interpret our signature as being much more than we think it is. We think it should be ratified before it's the law of the land. Of course, some of us think that even if it is ratified, if it contradicts the Constitution, it shouldn't be the law of the land either, because you can't ratify the Constitution with a treaty. But anyway,
hold on a second. I mean, you've got a couple of so-called agreements that have the clout of treaties in NAFTA and GATT, and you've been SOL trying to do anything about that.
I know. That's a big problem, because they do take that, and it becomes the law of the land. They literally believe now that they can amend the Constitution, you know, through this process. So in a way, you can do that without even the House participating. And I have, you know, do you recall the Bricker Amendment?
Sure.
Okay, I'm approaching that. I've introduced a recent resolution, because if you just listen to the Constitution, you don't really need the Bricker Amendment, because you're not supposed to do that, and it should be very clear. The Bricker Amendment would state that very clearly, that you can't change the Constitution. So I have a sense of Congress resolution that I've introduced to just at least get that discussion out and say, hey, you know, what are we doing? Why do we give up so much? We give up our sovereignty. We give up this power that it should be in the hands of the members of Congress. And now we're letting the WTO write our tax laws for us. So it to me is a very serious infraction in the Constitution.
But when Clinton signed this thing on December 31st, a couple of things happened. Number one, he signed the treaty. So the world looks at it, the U.S. signed the treaty. It doesn't go into effect unless the Senate approves it. And even this Senate's not going to approve this deal.
But just remember how powerful the presidents are through executive order, again, at neglect of the Congress. If Clinton wanted to impose environmental regulations that were coming out of the Kyoto Treaty, which was not signed and was not ratified, I mean, he can just do it through executive order. And the Congress just sits back and doesn't say anything. Oh, I don't want to
be... I'm glad you brought that up, because here's another pet peeve, okay? Executive orders, although they've become the classic abuse of power under the color of authority and have been misused and misconstrued, Congress can overturn any executive order, or for that matter, could eliminate the whole executive order tool. Why the hell don't you guys do that? I mean, he's poaching on your turf.
Well, if they pass us, I have another bill for that one, too, trying to make this point that we should not give this any president this power. So I have a bill that would say the only executive order he can issue are the ones that are authorized by the Constitution, like special sessions of Congress. He's the commander-in-chief of the military and a few things like that. But all the rest, including all the regulations of the agencies, including the regulations of the 1,500 pages for the so-called protecting our medical privacy, all that would be thrown out the window because he couldn't do it.
At what point in his... I mean, the executive order tool, the mechanism, was designed as an executive branch tool. It was a management tool for the executive branch.
Right.
At what point was it assumed that... I mean, the classic case was what happened with the Mexican bailout. He went to Congress. He asked, hey, give me $60 billion. You guys said no. He said, okay. As Paul Begala said, stroke of the pen, law of the land. Bullfeathers.
Did it on their own. That's right. And, of course, to me, the worst executive order is... the key to one of the reasons why we fought our revolution was to take the power to wage war away from the king. So it's very clear in the Constitution that only Congress can declare war. And yet by executive order, we've been either executive order, again, under treaty through the UN, we've gone to war with UN resolutions. We continue to do this. I mean, even our current president has already bombed Iraq. Where did he get his authority? Oh, UN resolution.
What happened with the War Powers Act thing? And you were involved in that a couple of weeks ago, I think.
Right, and I've reintroduced my legislation with the executive orders, but I've separated out the War Powers resolution because, again, you know, things always work differently than what they're said to do. The War Powers resolution in the early 72, I think it was to stop them from fighting wars like Vietnam without declaration. Well, it turned out that it actually legitimatized fighting war for 90 days before he even has to talk to the Congress. So it's backfired. So I want to repeal the War Powers resolution because it has not prevented war. They go to war more often than ever.
Do you have any traction from your colleagues?
Not really. There's no interest.
You know, this keeps bringing back to a common theme here. Excuse me, but I mean, Congress seems to have just surrendered the incredible power that was given to them. I mean, first off, in 1913, they give away the was it Article 2? They give the Fed they turn it over. They turn it over to the Fed. Then they give up the war powers. I mean, what do you guys have to be there for?
You know, what else is there? If they can control the money, if they make
law to control the money, they don't need a Congress.
They've legalized counterfeit by a secret bank, the central bank, the Federal Reserve, and then we allow our presidents to wage war either by himself or under a UN resolution, and then we write our tax laws according to what the WTO tells us. No, it's serious, and I think it's been that people have been very complacent. They're fat and happy, and our prosperity has lulled them to sleep. But, you know, maybe that's coming to an end, and maybe the American people will wake up and say, hey, well, how did we get ourselves into this mess? But the big danger is they'll be even more eager to turn over more power if there are major crises. You know, look what they do in the Depression and war times. They give more power to a president.
I'll dig up one of my favorite quotes in a moment. I can take a brief pause right now for some business. We'll be back with Congressman Ron Paul. 877-456-6789 is a toll-free number. I'll stop monopolizing them. If you want to speak with Congressman Paul, give us a call. 877-456-6789. About 45 minutes past the hour. Jeff Metcalf here. We're speaking with Congressman Ron Paul about a variety of things. It was supposed to be primarily in the International Criminal Court, but it's such a joy to have me here. I'm kind of bouncing around a little bit. Before you joined us, we were talking to Bob Schultz from We the People about this whole tax protest thing. Uh-huh. And how it's finally starting to build a little bit of momentum. So they happen to buy the time in USA Today, but it's getting some attention. Bob mentioned that their previous efforts to reach out to both Congress and the executive branch and the judiciary fell on deaf ears. They were promised a lot of stuff that didn't happen. April, I think, 6th or 9th, they're going to be gathering again. At any point, can you see Congress ever addressing the questions that have been raised by Bill Benson and others about the ratification of the 16th Amendment?
No way. It's not going to happen.
That dog ain't going to hunt.
Because even if you had 110% proof that was absolutely correct, that it was never ratified, I mean, it would be so devastating to the establishment. I mean, how else can they run the government without your money? I mean, they need your money. It's like saying, do you expect the Congress in the next 6 months to systematically reduce their spending by 10%? You know, if we could trust them, if they told us they were going to reduce their spending, then you say, well, maybe they'll reduce taxes, maybe we'll do something. But they need your money. This is the reason why our privacy is disappearing, whether it's our financial privacy or whatever. They want to know where your money is and what you're doing. And no, they're not going to pay any attention to that. So I think...
Here's a question I've had. I mean, once upon a time, for a long time, the mainstream, there's been kind of a complicity between the mainstream media and government. And they've kind of controlled what the people out there were getting fed. Now, through this kind of information revolution of the symbiotic relationship between, you know, jokers like me on talk radio, the internet, It's like the vacuum that had been created by the mainstream is getting filled, and people are finding this stuff. And as more and more people find out, hey, the 16th Amendment wasn't properly ratified, the Federal Reserve isn't federal, it isn't reserve, it's a private scam, fiat money ain't going to work, it's designed. As more and more people get exposed to this, how can Congress, how long can they stall before they have to address it?
And you've just stated why we should be optimists on the long run, because I compare to being in Washington in the 70s, when it was very difficult to organize and reach people. Now, talk shows, radio, internet, I mean, it's just amazing what we can do. But I still argue that even with our numbers growing tremendously, that we're not on the verge of seeing a Congress doing the things that you're asking, because there's so much more power and influence on the side of these spending programs. They may want less taxes, but they do want these programs. There's too many special interests. But our numbers are very important. We have to keep growing our numbers, that they understand this, because soon the tax revolt will grow. It is growing. It's very big. It's bigger than most people realize. And I think that some do it with a lot of noise, and they know what they're doing. There's a lot doing it very quietly and just saying, I can't survive unless I work on Saturdays without paying my taxes. So there's a major revolt going on. And then when a financial collapse comes, which I suspect we will get, this government is going to have to admit to some of these problems. Now, there will be a tug of war between those who will say, well, what we need is more government, versus our numbers, which are growing, and saying, we're going to chuck it. We're not going to participate. We're going to demand that we live within the Constitution. Now, that is not going to be graceful. It's not going to be smooth. It's not going to be through attrition in Congress, because those who get to Congress basically are the ones who are there now, and they're going to respond by saying, we have to keep this together for the good of the people. I mean, we have to make sure that nobody misses their check.
Yeah, but
almost
if,
every household gets a check now.
What if 10 or 20 years from now there is such outrage and so much information has been disseminated to the people that they finally get it, and they say, hey, you guys, you're not doing what you're supposed to. You're not representing us. You're representing your special interest and feathering your own bed. We're going to throw your fat asses out.
Well, I work on the assumption that that's possible, or I wouldn't be a political activist, and I am encouraged that I can go and vote the way I do and come back to my district. I have a district that has 22 counties, mostly farming. I don't vote for farm subsidies, and I explain my position. And they listen to me, and they still vote for me. So there is reason to believe it can happen. But it's not going to be soon, and it's not going to be easy. And I would think that the tax revolt and the financial collapse is going to bring it to an end a lot sooner than you're going to see a transition in the Congress. But we should work. We should work for education and understanding. Then we should work to change the Congress. Then we should be prepared for the rest.
Now, see, I've been telling people for 10 years, don't do anything stupid. Work within the system. Change the system. Fix what's broken. Don't do anything precipitous. You're telling me I'm wrong?
No, I'm saying that's what I do, and that's what we should do, but we ought to be prepared for the other. I don't know what the future will bring. Maybe all of a sudden the Congress will reflect our views a lot better than I think they're going to, and that they'll cut. See, it won't work unless
maybe
cut
the sun will come up in the west in the morning, too.
Yeah, they have to cut spending. So when they get in these tax arguments about, you know, whether it's a legal tax or illegal tax, to me it's irrelevant. Should we have a sales tax or an income tax? I hate the income tax. I'll do anything to get rid of the IRS. But that's not really the point. That's the symptom of the disease. The disease is that we've allowed our government to get so big and we've established a nanny state and a warfare state. And we have allowed our Congress to give up all their responsibilities to the courts and to our president. So that's where the problem is. The IRS and the income tax is the symptom of the problem. So we have to deal with the big picture as well.
Mr. Congressman, stay with us. We'll take a brief pause. We'll come back and wrap things up. I'll get to Paul in Falls Church, Virginia. I'm Jeff Metcalf. 877-456-6789 is a toll-free number. Don't go away. Okay, 54 minutes past the hour. We're going to get a bit on time pretty soon. We're speaking with Congressman Ron Paul, and I wanted to get to Paul in Falls Church, Virginia. You're on the air with Congressman Ron Paul.
Yeah, this is really has been very interesting, and a lot of us listening are as frustrated as we can be, wondering what in the world we can do. What do we do? We hear this. We would like. How do we help move the legislation? If we write to our congressman, does it matter? How can we? What can we do? That's what I want to know.
Paul, thanks for the question. Mr. Congressman,
well,
sure.
I think we all have a responsibility. I have a responsibility to introduce the proper legislation. Then I have a responsibility to try to get others to understand what it is and to support it. In this case, on the International Criminal Court, the resolution I have, if I could get co-sponsors, it would help. That means anybody that's listening, if they'd call their congressman and raise Cain with them, ask them to support my resolution, which is HCON Res 23, that would be very helpful. If they call up a website, which is thelibertycommittee.org, and they can find a resolution that they can sign, and this will be sent to the president, let the president know where we stand. We don't want him to have this ratified. We want him to announce to the world that this treaty should not be accepted. Then this would be very helpful. So we all have a responsibility. We have a responsibility to educate ourselves as to what's going on and then become politically active. I still think, although it's frustrating to me because we don't have these major victories in Washington, to me we have to work through the process the best we can and try to push legislation. I have, if anything, had more successes than I thought I would, you know, in Washington by, you know, just sticking to principle and asking for support. So the more people that could contribute their name and their emphasis with the other congressmen, the more it could help us.
Congressman Paul, I want to thank you very kindly for being with us. Check out that thelibertycommittee.org. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Take care. Ron Paul, good guy. Hey, don't forget that knowledge is power if, this is a huge if, as you just heard, if you take that knowledge and you do something with it, then you have an opportunity to be part of the solution instead of part of the problem. If you do that, then you too, like Bob Schultz, Congressman Ron Paul, Dave Shippers, and others, you can and you should be a champion.